Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to our next episode, which is titled The City in the Camp. I'm really pleased to be joined today by a dear friend, Dr. Ehem Dalal, who is an architect and urban planner with over 8 years of experience in researching refugee camps. He has curated two exhibitions and directed an award-winning film on the architecture of camps in Berlin. Ehem is the author of the book From Shelters to Dwellings, The Zaatari Refugee Camp, published by Transcript Verlag in 2022, and the co-editor of the book Tempo Home, published by TU Berlin University Press, also in 2022. He was a research associate at the Refiguration of Space Center at TU Berlin and a postdoctoral fellow at CNRS France. Since February this year, Ehem works as a lecturer at the Department of Architecture and Urban Design at the German University in Cairo. Welcome to the podcast, Ehem. We're delighted to have you here.
Thanks, Romola. Thanks for the invitation. I'm so happy to be part of your podcast series.
I've been really excited about your book. I have enjoyed reading it, and I want to congratulate you on this fantastic book coming out.
Thank you so much.
So on that then, I wanted to start by asking you to talk a little bit about it. And since, you know, we're going to be talking about urban issues, you've got this wonderful ethnographic detail in your book, and I wanted to ask you if you could reflect a little bit on what you see are the urbanization processes in Zaatari camp, where you did so much of your work.
Well, when it comes to the urbanization of the camp, the book has been like a part of a longer journey. So I was doing lots of visits to the camp in 2014, and then like later on in 2017, I did the bigger chunk of the field work. And I always go back to the point where refugee camps were like the planning of these camps, how is it usually working? So we have this handbook for emergencies, as you know, that tells the people how the space is planned and how it's supposed to be, you know, structured. And there is a very interesting point here that I think it's really worthy of looking at, which is this kind of understanding of space as an abstract medium. You know, you have this kind of distinction between what they call the open spaces. So you have these kind of open spaces versus covered spaces, which is like the amount of spaces that should be given for each an individual person. And of course, this kind of hierarchy of this kind of, let's say, this dichotomy of covered and open spaces somehow dictates the arrangement of the camp and how it should be organized. Of course, we know it from everyday life that space is not abstract and it's not a container, as Lefebvre says. So it is what happens in the camp and why it is so urban is that all this kind of dichotomy of space somehow start to break up gradually. We start to see different degrees of social spaces. We start to see the kind of development of this kind of private spaces, semi-private, semi-public, public spaces that somehow this kind of division, this kind of range of spaces starts to orchestrate the space in the camp, the elements inside the camp, the caravans, the tents, the infrastructure. On the one hand, this kind of emergence of social space is one of the main aspects why the camp starts to get this kind of urban nature. We start to see people sitting outside on the porches. We start to see people socializing, of course, around the caravans, around the shelters, around the dwellings that they kind of construct. We start to see kids playing outside. We start to see shops starting to emerge out of the, you know, near the spaces that are most vibrant, the most dynamic. We start to see, of course, also cultural spaces like Madafa, or which is the place where, you know, played a very important role in Syria back then, where, you know, elderly would be sitting and meeting and trying to navigate conflicts among the community. We see all this kind of arrangement of elements somehow trying to tell us that this open versus covered space is not really working. There are, you know, spaces political, it's economic, it's social, and these aspects start to reflect in the arrangement of the camp. For example, the emergence also of this huge market, this what they call the Champs-Élysées. Of course, the humanitarian people, of course, call the Champs-Élysées, but refugees call it the market simply, just to clarify. And I mean, these kind of spaces really signify this urban dimension. So this kind of diversity of spaces that emerge, but also these kind of spaces that emerge in the camp show us the diversity of people behind the camp itself. So in Za'atar camp in particular, we see that refugees are not all the same. So we have, for example, city dwellers, people who used to live in cities for a longer period of time. We see also rural migrants, people who come from rural areas. We see also Bedouins. So all these kind of identities start to show up in the space, and they try to, you know, manifest itself or themselves in different ways through architecture, through practice, through you know, all these kind of dynamics that emerge out of it really tell us that the space is urban in many ways.
This is a space that was really designed in a disciplinary fashion, right? It's a space of control. Mm-hmm. And what you're suggesting is that through these practices of living in certain kinds of spaces, that people rearrange space and it becomes much more social. Mm-hmm. So are there more sort of elements that you see emerging from your fieldwork? Do you see neighborhoods emerging in Za'atari camp, for example? It's a really interesting story about the market, and I wonder whether you'd want to tell the audience a bit more about that. But also with the political angle, I'm just wondering if you could tell us what kind of politics you saw emerging mm-hmm. in Za'atari.
Well, I mean, first of all, about the politics, of course, there were ways of trying to practice politics. So, as you said, the camp is somehow a disciplinary machine, somehow in its own arrangement. They try to, you know, warehouse refugees, although there are many policies now today speak about trying to avoid this kind of approach. But what happened is that people started to slowly, there was a need to interact with the people who govern the camp, basically UNHCR and also other Jordanian NGOs. And because of that, there were forms of urban governance on the refugee level. So, for example, the street leaders who emerged in 2014 were this kind of form of informal leaders. They were trying to communicate, they create bridges of communication between refugees and between the UNHCR and all the other actors. And of course, this is not, you know, probably politics as we want to have in the best sense, but it is a form of governance. And the politics of the camp, I think, also has a lot to do with, again, this kind of maybe a lot of resistance and a lot of demands that were put from refugee sides on the UNHCR, on the people who run the camp. For example, people were demanding a lot of much more caravans or shelters than was already given at some point. You know, attempting to demand certain aspects is a certain kind of citizenship, if you want, insurgent citizenship within the camp, you know, context of the camp. These kind of attempt to claim the space, to inhabit the space, are forms of politics. The camp has developed one of the biggest markets. I mean, was really very, very dynamic, very vibrant. The UN organizations, I mean, mostly in the Western media, or like in the media, it has been always called as this is the Champs-Élysées, which I think was way of trying to market the space of the camp and try to bring much more attention of the donors and say, guys, look, we have something here that's really absurd, but also very creative that you need to you know, pay attention to. But you know, people mostly refer to camp to the market of the camp as a souk. So, and maybe the much more hidden politics, or let's say the kind of aspects that influenced the geography of the camp, was the donation of the caravans, as you would have noticed, this kind of people trying to refer to certain quarters or neighborhood according to where these caravans were donated from. So for example, we have the Saudi quarter, we have the Kuwaiti quarter, Qatari, all these kind of small, you know, archipelago of Gulf countries within the camp. This was not something very visible for, let's say, UN actors. But I think when I was doing the field work, many people were referring to, you know, these things as, you know, like Hayy Saudi, Hayy Qatar, Qatari, ila akhirih. So that's in a way also a form of manifesting politics and showing how politics reflect on the space of the camp. And in regard to the question of the neighborhood, in the oldest part of the camp, there was this kind of clusters where people, I kind of made a small survey asking the people of the cluster about whether they think this is a neighborhood or where are the boundaries of this neighborhood. So where do you think these boundaries begin and end? And of course, you have these kind of different variations of answers because people were trying to associate or relate themselves or even position themselves vis-a-vis the space of the camp in general. Some of them were like, okay, no, my neighborhood is this small caravans next to me, my relatives. Some other people were like saying, okay, no, all of the inhabitants, all of the refugees living in this street are my neighbors. This is my neighborhood. The people from where it starts to where it ends. And others were saying, okay, no, the whole camp, the entire camp is my neighborhood. So you see this kind of scaling, this kind of understanding of the neighborhood, the kind of, you know, maybe one could call it even sense of belonging in a way that was emerging in the camp at that sense, that in that time, you know, varying in scale also from the small unit to the bigger, to the bigger, to the bigger.
Let me then take you in the other direction, mm-hmm. which is to think about an article that you have written previously about the camp-like conditions of refugee housing in Germany. So where do you see the sort of similarities and the coming together of these kinds of spaces?
There is definitely distinction between what a camp in the global south perspective is and what is, you know, the camp in the European, more like Western perspective is. The difference, the main difference is, of course, the understanding of the durable solution thing. So when you speak about refugee camps, we try to think of spaces that are built for refugees for a temporary period of time until the conflict is resolved and then and until people can actually, you know, go back and return to their home countries. Whereas in the detention center, we see this process of processing people to get into territory, trying to prepare them to get into a new place. In that sense, these spaces are, of course, a pass-through for people. They pass through them, and they are not meant to stay there. So now, there was, of course, many also similarities between the research in Zaatari camp and the things that we've seen in Tempo homes in Berlin. They were mostly related to the idea of the dwelling and, this, of course, this relations between people. So the interesting part was people, refugees, were always trying to appropriate space in order to be able to dwell in it. So there was demand that they have to, you know, figure out the need, the spaces for the everyday life, the you know, the dwelling in itself, for example, the rooms, the kitchen, the living area, the place for receiving guests, sleeping room, all these kind of spaces were most of the time missing from the, you know, arrangement of the camp and also from the detention center, or let's say the accommodation center, the Tempo home in Berlin. So people were trying to create these. They were trying to reproduce these spaces. They were trying to generate this kind of sense of, let's say, even if temporarily, it's a sense of settlement that they are actually settled in these spaces and they have some kind of daily life practice that they do this and that, and they have all these kind of places for actually visiting guests, you know, even in a one room that is about 3 to 5 meters, there were always corners where they said, okay, yeah, I can receive guests here. When trying to kind of recreate this kind of social life that people were very proud of, especially people from the Middle East, Syrians, for example, mostly proud of having, you know, big houses with many rooms that they can actually receive guests. And sometimes they exaggerate with the sizes of the room and say, yeah, it was 6 to 10 and we had a huge, I mean, but nonetheless, it's for them was a source of pride. And I think people try to create these spaces again. They try to arrange in every possible way this kind of possibility of receiving guests, of welcoming, of maintaining a sort of normal life that they have lost and on the way. So this is something that I think maybe in the context of Tempo homes, they were not able to produce, let's say, neighborhoods or quarters, but at the same time, this kind of neighborly relationships, these kind of knowing neighbors, bringing them, you know, inviting them for coffee, for tea, all these kind of things had an impact on people's life. And they also, in a way, created some kind of similarity in the situation that they are both in waiting, but they don't really surrender to this waiting. They are trying to live life. They're trying to continue, and they're trying to, you know, bring their knowledge and their culture, their identity to the space in every way possible.
Just to ask you about the Berlin Temple Homes question again, were the areas mixed in terms of who was living there? So did you have different groups?
Initially, the planning of the camps, especially in Berlin, was meant to somehow educate people about some kind of social order that they were, you know, getting themselves into, which is the German, you know, city, basically. So they were trying to tell people, no, we are here to tell you that it's a mixed country. We are all mixed. We have to deal with each other. So for that, they were trying to kind of put people, they were trying to diversify the camp as much as possible. They were trying to kind of create mixture in the population of the camp. For example, you have Syrians, you have Iraqis, you have Pakistanis, you have people from Afghanistan, you have people from, you know, Iran, Nigeria, you know, many countries from around the world. And they were trying to put these people in contact with each other and trying to kind of, let's say, rehabilitate them. That's basically what these spaces are meant to do. They are trying to help people to, you know, process them in a way to kind of get them prepared to get into the society. That's the difference, actually, from the camp, as we mentioned before. But then at the end of the day, people were at some point wanting to group, of course, because these networks, these kind of connections they had between each other, they're also source of solidarity for them. They were very, very, very important. And I remember one interesting example was that people in Tempo homes were not allowed to receive guests after 10 p.m. So at night, so the guests had to leave after 10. And that was a crucial issue for people, especially from the Arabic context, because receiving guests and being able to receive guests was very, very, was a source of power for them, because they relied on these relations, they relied on these networks that they can receive guests coming from another city, from Köln, even if they stay, for example, let's say, 2, 3 days, 5 days, they needed to have these people next to them in order to kind of survive within this new context. Another interesting thing was that people were, at many occasions, they were also scattered on different rooms, different units, and different camps, to fix them in certain position, was creating lots of tensions, was creating lots of conflicts, and people were always fighting to kind of either group together or come back to certain camps where most of their friends and acquaintances were living. So there was one example also of a guy who was brought to a better kind of camp, like that looks more like a housing. And then he was like refusing that he wanted to go back to his place, to the place where he first arrived, and where, you know, because he had lots of plants and lots of things and herbs that he planted, and he knew the people, and it you know, gave him a sense of also comfort and you know, confidence that these kind of places, these people, these things that I know that, you know, make me feel much more secure and ready to face this new environment. So, you know, these groupings were important in many aspects. Yes.
So I'm wondering whether you could tell us what you think is a relationship between camps and cities, and what you think their future is based on the research that you've done and the observations that you've made.
Well, first of all, it seems that camps are increasing worldwide. Like, this is something we all are becoming familiar with. In 2014, there was this attempt to kind of stop, you know, building camps, you know, this kind of alternative to camps, no camp policy, saying, okay, we want to avoid camps as much as possible. But we still witness that camps are still being built, they're still being produced, they're still being constructed, and they somehow have a value for people who have lost access to cities to adequate housing. The example I'm giving here is particularly from the northwestern region of Syria. So we have this region that have, you know, at least three main cities like Aleppo, Idlib. You know, it was a normal region, and because of the conflict now and the creation of, let's say, the division of the territory in Syria, of course, we have this territory that's somehow being supervised currently by Turkey. We have about 1,500 camps that are being built. This is a major addition to camps that are already existing in the Levant and the Middle East. And this is telling us that, you know, the kind of proliferation of these camps is telling us something that, you know, camps, at least cities in the Middle Eastern context, or let's say the Levantine context, have been failing to receive people to become hospitable places for embracing people from different backgrounds. I mean, we also see one of the examples that if we speak about the Levant in particular, we see now a lot of difficulties that the cities are facing. For example, you know, we see explosions, Homs, for example, 80% of the city is destroyed. People being, you know, many cities are being depopulated for different reasons. And camps are becoming a way of, you know, welcoming these people who have lost a lot. They have been, maybe they are citizens, maybe they are not necessarily refugees, maybe they are migrant workers, maybe. But the city has did not allow them to access its services and infrastructure and housing. So they somehow end up living in camps. So this is, in this perspective, in this particular region, I see that camps are, you know, gaining also a little bit of significance, which is, just to clarify, the camps can never substitute the importance of cities. We all want to live in cities. We want to all live in just and fair cities that offer, you know, infrastructure, accommodation, services to all parts, to all people in a fair way. But within this context, we see what UN described as long-running crisis. The region is going in a long-running crisis, and also the world, if you want, except a few privileged regions and territories, we see the camp as somehow becoming a way of producing urban life, producing the city when the city failed to be the place that should embrace everyone. That is basically why I see the camp still has, although of course a place of control and care, we know all these kind of contradictions, a space where it's a conditional space, you know, until this resolution is found. But when is this resolution found? When this crisis ends? That's the question.
I want to end on a question about yourself. And talk about your identity as a Palestinian, Jordanian, who's been raised in Syria. And I want to ask you, how did your identity shape the way in which you approach this topic and your fieldwork, and also the reflections that you've just made, which are incredibly powerful?
Well, to be honest, this kind of hybridity of identity, if you want, made me very, very sensitive to how these borders are instructed in the Middle East, in the Levant, because the Levant, I mean, this region in particular is really is still struggling from the traces of colonialism, the kind of the borders and the nationalities, the identities that were produced in the aftermath of the colonial mandate of the region. So we have all these people that were produced, categories, most importantly, categories that also relate a lot to the camps, because camps is to contain certain categories. So we have all these people that were produced, the Palestinian refugee, the, you know, the Palestinian who's still in Palestine or in Israel. We have, you know, Jordanians, we have Syrians, we have Lebanese, we have inside these, of course, nation states with still lots of subgroups and sub-identities. So for me, it's always a possibility to be more aware and more, let's say, yeah, aware is the word, to be more aware and more sensitive to these kind of identities. For example, when I go to, and this is also this kind of borders, this kind of colonially structured borders and identities bring lots of trouble to my own self everyday life. And when I'm in Jordan, for example, if I'm introducing myself as Jordanian because I have a Jordanian passport from my parents, the people are always confused because I speak Syrian dialect, because I was born and raised in Syria. I know lots of Syrians and they're like, no, you are not Jordanian, you're Syrian. When I'm in Syria, they're like, oh wow, but you don't have the passport, you have Jordanian passport, how this works. We also have relatives who are from Lebanon, my grandmother. So it's, you know, this kind of biography really today tells me a lot about how these borders were constructed. These borders were constructed on my family's biography. Eventually, they were like preventing some people from visiting some other areas, you know, creating all these kind of divisions in a very, very small region like the Middle East or the Levant, where people, you know, coming from Beirut to Amman would take, you know, if you don't with cars, if you don't want to go with cars, it takes me hours. And if you go from Syria to Amman, it's also taking 12 hours minimum, which is like speaking about a few kilometers. So all this kind of distancing, these kind of borders and these kind of ways of creating distances between groups is actually why also the camp is a very important element in this particular arrangement, that they put people in this kind of space where distances are created between groups and between, you know, geographies. So this is why I was also maybe becoming much more sensitive to the topic of refugee camps and why I was interested in it in the first place. Not to mention that my father also worked his entire life in camps, of course, in Palestinian camps in Lebanon, in Beirut, and also in Homs in Syria. And I was visiting these camps and they were looking, it was all very, you know, normal. They looked for me as part of the city, of course, but then when I grew up, I started to understand why they are important in our context, because they symbolize all these kind of problematics of politics, all these kind of entangled, you know, entangled histories and politics that that still affecting our everyday life. They are not something in the past. They still exist. And that's why these camps are in a way a symbol of this kind of dilemma of a region that has lots of borders and distances and groups and categories in a very, very tight, you know, small space. So another thing that has affected the, you know, my research based on my identity is also, of course, the fact that I was myself also being displaced. You know, when I had to leave Syria in 2011, you know, I became also a displaced person. And I think that is something that also put me in so much, made me maybe more sensitive also to what's happening in the camps. I remember having, you know, when I did the first visit to Za'atari camp, that was 2014, I was doing my master's studies, and afterwards I kind of discovered that in fact I am also missing the need to dwell. I was like being in a way very uprooted in ways that I didn't recognize before. So the research in the camp allowed me actually to connect with that dimension, to kind of think about, okay, how to settle in these kind of situations. What happens when, you know, you're far away, you're distant, you're like sometimes also don't have these kind of networks of solidarity, of connection. So how to settle, how to dwell in this kind of context. And the most interesting thing was when I was checking the literature, there was lots of connection with Westerners trying to kind of explain, of course, what dwelling is in different contexts and how things work and what is homemaking. There was also lots of in the academia, there was many people trying to kind of tap on this because it was somehow emerging topic at that time, you know, this kind of homemaking, refugees making homes, and okay, this is so great. But for me, it was more of also existential question myself. So I felt that most of the research I was doing at that time was in many ways therapeutic for me as well, to kind of think about, okay, but I also need to dwell in many ways. And it also, maybe it also made me also more sensitive to the notion of dwelling, because the dwelling is not simply creating a home, but also, you know, needing to settle, needing to feel that you are secure, needing to think that your privacy is met, needing to feel that you belong in this particular place, regardless of what politicians tell you, of what the society may be telling you or whatever. This is a place for us to kind of like be anchored and you know, integrate with the world and life itself. So this is, I think, why I also came to write about dwelling in the first place, and why I came to think about whatever this process that was taking place, this kind of urbanization of the camp, was in many ways connected to this notion of creating a home, but also dwelling in the sense of settling down, of creating the safety, creating security, maintaining social relations in different forms, and trying to reproduce life as people knew it. So I think all these things somehow influence, you know, this background I have somehow influenced my work.
Well, thank you so much for such an exciting set of thoughts and sharing your research with us. It's been such a rich discussion. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure that the audience has also had so much to think about in listening to you today. So thank you so much for joining us, and all the very best as well with your future work. And I can't wait to read that as well.
Thank you so much, Tramula. Thanks for the invitation. I'm also happy to be part of this great podcast series.